This is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path, Part 6.
August 24th, morning, in Des Moines, New Mexico. Any questions about technique or practice points? Leslie?
I was wondering if you could talk about the use of gaze, and particularly eyes closed and then different levels of gaze. Different levels of gaze.
Yes. In when you're working with things like the Four Immeasurables, those kinds of practices, positioning of your eyes is probably not so important. You're generally just going to let the eyes rest. And I'm not even sure it makes a big difference whether you're using eyes open or eyes closed. Generally, in Mahayana schools, one meditates with the eyes open and Theravada eyes closed, but that's not universal. The when you've one of the instructions when you're experiencing dullness is to raise your eyes and look up a little bit. It helps to clear the mind when you're experiencing a lot of activity, and then you want to relax, and so you'll probably lower the gaze and just let the whole system relax. And that's generally the case when there's dullness, you want to bring more energy into the system. When there's activity, it means there's tension in the system, so you want to relax. Yesterday we talked about just recognizing. And in that just recognizing, there's a shift in which mind or heart or experience, whatever word you want to use, is clear and open. In the beginning, it's relatively short. As you begin to stabilize this, then you mix it with experience, so that you look at a tree. Just recognize seeing the tree. Or you look across the valley. So you're actually mixing that open, clear awareness with experience. And this brings a very awake quality to everything. And also, and I was going to talk about this anyway, so it's good that you ask, you're starting the process of being able to maintain or move into, which would be better to say, move into that empty, clear awareness in activity. And one of the things I was going to say this morning is that when you're going for a walk, do the same thing. You keep dropping into that empty, clear mind as you're walking. And so you begin to experience everything. And then you can do it when you're eating. And in more and more activities. It's a little harder to do it with sound. But you can practice it. It's even harder to do it with conversation. That takes a little bit of practice. But we're not doing a lot of conversation, so you can work on that later. And until you can experience everything that way. And this gives you a basis of clear, open awareness permeating your experience. Now, this is, again, I want to emphasize, don't try to hold on to this. It's a case of opening or dropping, whichever way you want to consider it, and resting there. And when it dissipates, it dissipates. Don't try to bring it back. Do it again. And that's that business of returning to it rather than trying to hold on to it. You can also, and some people find this very effective, is when they're practicing. You practice with the eyes wide open. Now, don't do this with the sun shining in your eyes, because it won't be good for you. But what you're doing here is letting a great deal of light come in. So the mind naturally becomes very bright, very clear, and you're resting in that clarity. Is that sufficient?
Yeah, that's helpful. And I wanted to ask a supplementary question.
A follow-up question.
Sometimes I'll notice my eyes going back and forth, like one's wanting to be the main one, then the other one, and sort of going, pulling, pushing back and forth. And what I've done is tried to let go of that and just then be more aware of the opening to whatever's the experience is in front of me. And then it seems like the gaze evens out when I do that.
Yeah, I think that's good. Rather than try to fix the eyes a certain way, you rest and let themselves, and let the eyes sort themselves out.
And then the other question was that I generally notice that emotional material is better worked with my eyes closed. I don't know if you have any comment on that.
Depends a little bit what practice you're doing, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. If you're resting in open experience and emotional material comes up, experience it with the eyes open. You won't be able to work with it the way that you're used to. That could be helpful.
Except what I notice is that I don't have much emotional material when my eyes are open. Like, at least not in practice, maybe in daily life, but...
Then it's not a problem, is it?
Well, that's right. Maybe you're just kind of like hiding out.
Pardon?
It's hiding out, perhaps.
If you're ascending, we'll track you down.
It does seem like, I don't know, physiologically, and I've read it somewhere too, that your limbic system becomes more open with your eyes closed.
That may be. As I say, if you're ascending, we'll track you down. You know, you seen the movie Up?
No.
Oh, why do you gotta see Up? Any other questions? Larry?
As one rests in this open experience, as you described the pointing out instructions last night that the Karmapa gave you on your retreat, as one begins to do that in these short intervals, what are the signals that one isn't just spacing out or going into momentary reverie?
What are you experiencing that gives rise to that question?
Well, the pointing out instruction, as I understand, is look, and as soon as a thought arises, relax. And so as I would look, there may be no presence of thoughts or emotional energy, but I'm not sure that I'm going in the right direction. I don't know
what
that
I'm...
What
do you experience when you look?
The sensation of looking, the visual pattern.
Look at your mind.
Pardon me?
Look at your mind. What do you experience?
I can't articulate it without using the overused word presence.
You're on the right track. Keep going.
Okay. But there are no warning signs to this kind of reverie that is so common in our Western, you know, expression of, you know, you go into a reverie, you go into this zone.
Yeah, I understand. But when I asked you to look at your mind, you didn't say, I'm experiencing a reverie, did you?
No, I did not.
Okay, so it's not a problem yet.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, when there is, we'll work with it.
Okay, thank you.
But right now, it's there. So that's it. No. Okay? Just 1 second, Paul, could you pass it over?
This is just a logistical question about the Qigong.
Yes.
Did I miss it this morning, or is it yet to be...
A Qigong lesson?
Yes.
No, we'll do one probably around 4 this afternoon.
4, okay.
Okay, I'll work it out with Claudia.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's close here. Breakfast should be shortly. Thanks. August 24th, evening session at A Trackless Path, Des Moines, New Mexico. Okay, last night we talked at some length about Mahamudra practice. I made the reckless statement last night that I was going to talk about Mahamudra and relationship. Well, we didn't get to relationship. To begin with, I'd like to take up any questions that may have come out of your... out of last night's discussion or out of your practice today on Mahamudra. So, floor's open. No answer came, the stern reply. No questions? Nothing? That makes my life easy. Okay. Relationships. Big topic, of course. But all of us have chosen to live life in the world and to practice living and working. Almost everybody here has a family. So it's a world of relationships at home, at work, friends, socially, and so forth. And it, well, to quote Zorba the Greek, wife, family, work, career, the full catastrophe. Now, some years ago, the assistant to one of the executives that I coach was a young Indian woman. who had made a short documentary about the Kumbh Mela, which is a Shivite festival in India that takes place at the confluence of the Ganges, and I can't remember the other river. And it's a two-week festival that occurs only once every 11 years. And at this festival, there's something like 10 or 11 million people over a two-week period. I mean, here in this country, we can't imagine that larger crowd. And so she has clips and of all of the Shivite sadhus. And it was, I just found it very interesting to watch, because this is exactly how Buddhism started. That Buddha had come to a level of experience or understanding and attracted followers. And this is what happens in India. And these were people who gave up the gave up civil and social life in order to pursue practice. And in this movie, there's this documentary, there's a clip of like probably between 1,000 and 2,000 Indian men who are all naked. They're only wearing ashes and things like that, because that's what the Shivites do. And they're all ages, from all different sectors of Indian society. Some of them obviously were from very wealthy families, some are very poor. And all of them are formally giving up social and civil life in order to pursue their spiritual practice. And they live in very small communities and survive on begging, doing the rounds every day, which was part of the Buddhist monastic tradition, still is. And I just found it fascinating watching this, because, oh, this is like stepping back in time. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is that Buddhism is a religious mendicant tradition at bottom. That's how it started. And the whole thesis underlying Buddhism from its inception is a life of renunciation, so you can focus and develop focus your attention on the deepest questions you have about life. And as such, it was part of the Indian tradition, which saw that as a young man you were a warrior or plied your trade, and then when you got everything established, you took a wife, raised a family, and when you reached a certain age, then you gave all of that up and entered the religious life. Robert Bly views this as the red, the white, and the black, and three stages of life in the men. For women, it's white, red, black. Different order. Now, that basis, as Buddhism spread out of India, and as the economic and political and social conditions in India changed, Buddhism adapted to a certain extent, and certainly it took very, very different forms in different cultures, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, China, Japan, Tibet, Mongolia, Russia. And when you look at these different forms of Buddhism, they actually have probably greater differences in form than Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. that they preserved this core remarkably well through all of these different cultures. And so in all of these different geographic locations, there has been a very, very strong monastic tradition. In Tibet, it took over the country. One third of the male population were monks. Creates a certain economic and imbalance, which is why Tibet developed into a theocracy. It didn't reach that anything like that proportion in China. In Japan, they ran into some political problems, and so the celibate monastic tradition was kind of ruled out of order, and the priests were forced to marry, and so you get all kinds of funny things happening in Japan. But these themes remain very, very strong. In Sri Lanka and Malaysia, the monastic traditions continued very strongly. And over time, the people who practiced in this tradition were part of the social fabric and became elders and advisors. This happened definitely in Southeast Asia and Tibet, certainly, and to some extent in China and Japan. So people would go to them for advice, and that they served a very definite social function. And lay communities built up and support developed around these and supported them. And some of them were pulled into performing marriages and things like that. But in Tibet, there weren't any. There wasn't any Buddhist marriage ceremony. That's only been made up in the West. If you were getting married in Tibet, you went to the local lama, and he might do a white Tara empowerment for the couple that were getting married. But the lama was never invited to the wedding reception for a very simple reason. The lama was celibate. To invite him to the wedding would be a bad portent for the couple. No children. So you had this kind of thing going on. So when you talk about Buddhism and in relationships, in terms of work in the world and in our families and so forth and so forth, there ain't much stuff. There really isn't much stuff. And you don't find that much in the sutras. And in preparing for this evening, I pulled out, Longchenpa's 30 pieces of advice, and I got the Tibetan, by the way, and I'm happy with my translation. I checked it. The independent part, I think, could be changed, but that's something we might discuss this evening. And I went through the 37 practices of a bodhisattva, and it's very, very clear the direction that these things are pointing. Simplify your life so you can focus your attention on your deepest questions about life. That's what they're talking about. So take a look at Longchenpa. And he's wonderful about this. on page 28. Actually, go to page 27, because this is where he really does it. And so you start at near the top, the second stanza. Managers, assistants, directors, and such provide the infrastructure for both communities and religious institutions. But your involvement in such matters gives rise to worry and concern. Limit your business. That's my sincere advice. And let's see. Bottom of page 26. Although you think you're serving the welfare of beings by acting as a guarantor, witness, or advocate to help settle others' disputes, your own opinions will inevitably assert themselves. Don't be concerned. That's my sincere advice. There is a group, I think it still meets, of Buddhist teachers, most of them nationally known. The meets in the Bay Area, I don't know how frequently, but I was part of it many, many years ago. But I got tired of making the trip up from Los Angeles. But one day, just being the kind of person that I am, that's why I get thrown out of things, I brought this along and just gave it to them all. And every one of them, as they started to read it, just turned green. And one of them said, and I just remember, he just looked and said, "This is my life!" Because he was doing all of these things. You collect a lot of pledges from the poor and use them to build big monuments, help the needy, and so on. The good works you do cause others to live badly. Goodness must be in your mind. That's my sincere advice. You know, and so it's very clear what Longchamp is pointing to. You know, let it all go. Don't look to be have any position in society or in these affairs. Simplify your life in the extreme so you can focus your attention on what you feel is truly important to you. Now, this is not what any of us have chosen to do. There's a lot of good advice in here, but it's oriented in a specific direction. And if you go to 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva, the second one, attraction to those, stanza number two of the practices, that is, after the first two introductory ones. Attraction to those close to you catches you in its currents. Anybody have any familiarity with that one? Okay. Aversion to those who oppose you burns inside. That ring any doorbells? Indifference that ignores what needs to be done is a black hole. Now you get the advice or the practice of a bodhisattva. Leave your homeland. How many of you have done that? And Milarepa is famous for saying, and it's true, if you want to give up anger, leave your homeland. Leave your native country. If you really want to get away from anger, got to get out of your native country. I've done that. I'm not sure I got out of anger, but left my native country. So, you can see where all of this is pointing to. Now, I've been reading a book that was recommended to me by my friend and colleague Stephen Batchelor, called Philosophy as a Way of Life. It's by, I think it's Philippe Hadot, H-A-D-O-T, who's a French academic who's studied Greek philosophy, Greek and Roman, very, very deeply. A lot of other philosophy, too. And the Greeks approach this whole matter very, very differently. And philosophy for them was not an abstract study or interest. It was a ongoing questioning of how to live. And people who studied with people like Socrates or Plato later, but I really think Plato screwed things up badly. But there are many others, the Stoics, the Epicureans, etc. They were encouraged to live in Zorba, the Greeks' world, the full catastrophe. And how do you actually do this? I have a friend who studied in India for many years, and very, very highly trained, and was a monk for many years. Had earned a very considerable level of respect from Tibetans for his intelligence and the quality of his practice. And had a very senior position in one of the Western institutions that had come out of that particular lineage. And he met a woman, fell in love, and gave it all up. And I feel very fortunate to have had a few conversations with him. And his reason was, apart from falling in love, was very simple. I've learned all this stuff. Let's see what it's like in practice. How do we actually live it? And in this respect, he was very much more, or is very much more, in the tradition of the Greek philosophia than the tradition of Buddhist renunciation. So, this evening, I'm going to give probably what is a completely chaotic account. I've given some thought to it over the last day or so, but I don't have a nice outline or set of notes to follow. So if it's a little chaotic, then please bear with me. And I'm going to talk about relationship in a fairly general way first. Some of the things that I've come to understand about. And I'm not just going to talk about intimate relationships, but to begin with, much more general view. And the framework I'm going to use for this is something that some of you are familiar with. Most of you who've read Wake Up to Your Life will have come across this because it's interspersed, though not dealt with really explicitly in that book. And that's the four ways of working: power, ecstasy, insight, and compassion. Is anybody here complete strangers to that? Okay, that's good. So, power relationships. Well, any of you see the movie Saving Private Ryan? It's probably one of the better war movies. It's pretty rough. But Tom Hanks' character is leading this squadron to behind enemy lines trying to find this Private Ryan. And there's internal tensions. And the nature of relationship in the army is... you do this because there's a man over you with a gun. And the same thing operated very much in the Russian army, in the fight against Nazi Germany. Russian troops who had zero armaments, no rifles, no bullets, nothing, were ordered into battle. And the first thing they had to do was to find a rifle and then find ammunition. And if they turned back, they were shot. That was it. 23 million people were killed. And those battles, huge numbers. So that's the essence of a power relationship, which can be summed up in the phrase, if you don't do this, things will be made very uncomfortable for you. That's the essence of a power relationship. Now, I've deliberately made it very explicit by referring to the military, because that's where it is most explicit, because much of what happens in the military is making people do what is contrary to their ordinary way of functioning, certainly their social way of functioning. And for better or worse, and that's a whole other discussion which we don't need to go into this evening. But any time there is a coercive element in a relationship, that is a power relationship. How many of you said to somebody, if you don't do that, I will be disappointed in you? That's a coercion. Now, a lot of people don't recognize it. And what I found also is interesting is that many people don't know how to be in a relationship unless there is a coercive component. And what that produces is a hierarchy. One is, has the power and the other is lower in power. However, coercion works both ways. The person on the top coerces the person on the bottom and think, oh, he has all or she has all the power. But that's not quite the case. Because the person on the bottom can do something, but not quite the way that it was meant to be done, or not quite at the pace that it was meant to be done. And in doing so, they're making things uncomfortable for the person above them. This is also coercion. And when it gets extreme, you get into sadomasochism. Julia's lovely phrase from the other day, masochistic submission. Yeah, and that's characterizing a relationship in which one person is accepting the coercion and deriving some kind of enjoyment or pleasure from it, or some kind of benefit, shall we say. Now, you get this in the business world all the time. For better, again, for better or worse. It can be more extreme or less extreme. But people are made to do things or their life is made uncomfortable for them. And you get it in a lot of other areas of society. Cults are coercive. Many aspects of our society, such as grad school, medical industry, an unfortunate number of non-profit organizations, etc., all work on the same principle. It's very widespread. So that's one kind of relationship and one kind of dynamic. And it probably is a good thing when you have some spare time to look at your relationships and to see what extent that element is present. That may be a little disturbing, but it's probably a useful thing. Now, the second kind, ecstatic relationship. This is typically love. It involves opening, and the relationship is about opening, or it comes about through opening. So it's a very different tone from the power relationship. Very different. There's an opening and a connection through opening. Where the dysfunction arises is lack of boundaries and slipping into addiction. You need that opening and that the energy that comes from it. So in the spiritual domain, you have teachers who have, or not necessarily even teachers, just people who have a tremendous amount of energy and they just pour it out in terms of loving kindness. And you get large numbers of people flocking around, just soaking it up and basking in it and so forth. Darshan, is that what it's called? Pardon? Okay. And there's not infrequent in India, but there's it happens in many, many cultures. And you get some people who spend their life going from one of these things to another. They become addicted to the energy. And that always brings out the other side of addiction, which is impotence. That without that, it can't do anything. This frequently comes up in relationships with artists, because part of the artistic sensitivity, part of the artistic curse, is that you're very open. It's what powers the art. So a lot of artists struggle with addiction issues. And if you look back over the course of history, you see that there's a very, very long string of artists who have died of various forms of addiction, some of them quite young. And that kind of relationship is very, very... Let's just put the problematic aspects aside for a moment and just look at the dynamics. In the power relationship, the aim is to get something done, because that's what power is about. In the ecstatic relationship, it's about opening. And all of you know through your own practice and through your own experience that opening to another person, or just being open, is a very wonderful experience. And that opening may come through love, it may come through devotion, it may come through cultivating loving kindness, as we do in various practices, it may come in various other ways. Because that opening raises energy, there is a sense of freedom. And one experiences the world a different way. Hence the phrase, fallen in love, experiencing the world through rose-colored glasses. And everything seems very alive, or is very alive in a different way. There's a vitality, a vibrancy, a richness, an enjoyment to life. To your experience of the other. And this is the basis of love relationships, friendship and marriage. And there's a desire to open completely so that you feel at one with the other, and as this course leads into sexual relationships. So that's that kind. Then there's insight relationships. Now, the quality of insight is you see into things. So in insight, and the typical insight relationship is the spiritual teacher and student, psychologist and client. Mentor and possibly even coach, these kinds of relationships. And you see just from the way I'm setting that up there that only relatively occasionally are they peer relationships. I had the very good fortune to have a peer insight relationship with a good friend over a we're still friends, but over a 16-year period, we worked together because we recognized that each of us had the keys to unlock where the other one was stuck in the spiritual practice. And so it's a very, very fruitful relationship. And there are instances in the Tibetan tradition where there are certain teachers who had that same kind of relationship. What happens in this relationship, in an insight relationship, is that things are being pointed out. What is going on inside the person is being pointed out, so the person can work with it in some way, free themselves from those reactive patterns or what have you. There's that quality of looking into. Now, when you're on the receiving end of this, your experience is of being cut. Being cut. Is this familiar to anybody here? Okay. Now, why would you allow someone to cut into you? Because you're tired of your patterns. Something like that. Because you feel in some way this can be helpful. And so what is very important in the insight relationship is the trust you have in the other, that they're cutting into you for your benefit, not for their own. There are plenty of instances where you see people cutting into each other, people for their own benefit. You know what we call these people? Manipulators. They see how the person, and they know how to get them to react in a certain way for the manipulator's benefit. That's an unbalanced, exploitive aspect of the insight relationship. But where it is a balanced relationship and a healthy relationship, the teacher sees where the student is stuck, and this could be a high school teacher, doesn't have to be spiritual teaching, it's just using that as an example, and is able to show the student where they're stuck in such a way that they can move forward and learn. And so implicit in this is the that it's about the person. The relationship is for the benefit of the person whose being stuff is being pointed out. And there has to be that confidence, whether you translate that as faith or trust or whatever you want, doesn't matter. You know what I'm talking about. That this is being done for your benefit. A friend of mine studies with another friend of mine, and he's pretty rough. I mean, he's really, really direct and not particularly gentle, but extremely effective. And she reported on one interaction, which was really hard, but she said, "I saw in his eyes that all that he wanted was to help me become free of suffering, so it didn't matter what he did after that." There was that level of trust. She could just see it. So that's really important. Then there's compassion relationship. Compassion's tough. It's tough because you don't have any control. You all know from your work in compassion that compassion means being able to be present with another person's pain. or to be present with that person when they are in pain. Now, when we see someone in pain, particularly if they're someone we care about, what's the impulse? To fix it, to get rid of the pain. Doesn't always work, does it? Because as soon as we move into that, we're going to take care of that person and fix their problem, we've actually are becoming dangerously close to moving into a power relationship. Only when we can actually be with that other person when they're in pain, does the possibility of actually being helpful to them open up. As long as we're having one needing to fix the pain or remove it because we're uncomfortable with it, then we're either in a power or insight relationship. We're either in coercive or manipulative relationship. And when someone you care about is in pain, it tears your heart out. Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story, which I really like this story, of a woman in a Vietnamese village who was very disturbing to the village, to everybody else in the village. She was a very angry, short-tempered woman with a great deal of devotion to Amitabha. And she would sit in her house and pray at the top of her lungs, you know, destroying any sense of tranquility or peace in the village. And was just brutal and vicious with anybody who spoke to her. After a while, the village elders realized they had to do something about this, and they met. And we'll call this woman Mrs. Fong. And one of the elders said, "I'll take care of it." So the next day, he waited till Mrs. Fong was praying to Amitabha Buddha and went over to her house and knocked on the door. Just knock, knock. Nothing. She just continued praying. So then she knocked, he knocked a little louder. The only response was an increased volume in the prayers. Finally, he knocked very loudly and says, "Mrs. Fong, it's so-and-so, village elder, please come down. I need to speak with you." There was a crash as she slammed her rosary on the floor. Stomp, 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 stomp. Doors flung open. "What do you want? Can't you see I'm in the middle of my prayers?" And after she'd finished her tirade, the village elder looked at her and said, "I'm so sorry to disturb you, Mrs. Fong, and I'm so sorry to upset you this way. But I've only been knocking at your door for 5 minutes. Can you imagine how Amitabha Buddha must feel?" Well, Amitabha Buddha, of course, is able to be present with other people's pain. It's the archetype of that. Find this expressed in Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig. And being present with the other person when they're in pain involves one of the instructions of mind training. Don't pick up what isn't yours. If the other person is in pain, that's their pain. You be with them in their pain, but you don't make it better for them. Now, that's not the actual instruction. That's my commentary on it. Let's see if I can find it. Oh. George was meant to put that in. Dan. We meant to have the mind training instructions in here. Okay. So I can't look it up right now. But it's something... It's worded a little differently in the mind training sections. I'll look it up and get back to you on it, because I haven't. No, that's the other side of it, and that's just where I was going. The other side of this is when something unpleasant comes to you, don't slough it off onto somebody else. And that's very important. Now, how many of you experienced somebody being with you, just being with you, when you've been in pain? What's that like? Anybody? Julia?
It's amazing. I just had two experiences of that when I once, one before this surgery I just had, where somebody who's a fellow practitioner came and sat with me before I went into the operating theater. And then another friend who's a very deep Catholic practitioner sat with me when I had a very adverse reaction to the anesthetic, and I was shaking for almost 24 hours, and just in the room, and just sat with me, held my hand. It's all he needed to do, nothing to be said, just to be there. It was incredible.
Yeah. Anybody else, Gary?
What I experienced was the comfort with silence. Mm-hmm. And I found an opening between us in that silence. And I expected it to be interrupted or closed, but the other person continued just to be present. And it actually softened me quite a bit. And it was just the quality of the opening that struck me in terms of the level of compassion mm-hmm. that I received.
Yeah. Anybody else? Leah.
Well, I think I told you about this experience, or at least a part of it. It was in a workshop setting. We were partnered up, and it was a practice in listening, a compassionate presence, actually. And the exercise was to share something that you're struggling with. When my partner went first, and just to listen to her was a relief for me also. And then when it was my turn, all I got out was the words, I'm struggling. And I just cried the rest of the time. And there was a few moments where I thought I would speak and tell her, but then I just cried more, and then the next thing you knew, the gong went, and it was a great gift. Yeah. It was so helpful of her.
Okay, these are all very good examples, and so that's a true compassionate relationship. The alternative, where you're trying to fix it or the opposite of that, just withdraw from it. That's very different. I want to go and pick up one piece that I left out with respect to power relationship. And this is on the positive side. By using power to push someone, you may get them to do more than they felt they were capable of. So they extend their capacity or develop a skill for something that they didn't know they had. And this has to do, and there will be an experience of joy in both on both sides. And I imagine most of you can think of instances where you had that kind of thing, where someone was pushing you, but pushing you in the right way. And something you discovered, and so there's a freedom, a capability, an increase, and it's celebrated, and that's a very important part of the power, that aspect of the power relationship. Okay, so that's a very general framework, and let's just pause here because I've given you quite a bit of material. Happy to take up any questions you may have about any of that before going and talking about how this might actually look in certain kinds of relationships we experience in life. Any questions any of you'd like to ask? Rob?
Well, I'll make a comment. The last thing others were talking about, my wife and I, after many years of trial and error with a lot of error, have learned to mostly sit with each other when we're in pain. And I'm talking about really big things like family members dying and so on. And what I find is that when she does that, it helps me to open to my own pain and my own experience, and she just allows me to do that. That's what I heard others saying. And the same is true for her. And yeah, it's just it's a real gift, and even in that there can be a kind of joy in a way.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Julia? And then Joan?
Yes. One thing that I thought is worth mentioning in relation to ecstasy is there is that confusional aspect of power with ecstasy. Like somebody trying to get somebody else to open to them.
Yes.
And people sort of being energy junkies off other people. So it's that sort of forcing open aspect. And that can be very
And that can be very confusing and problematic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. John?
The part about compassion that I just keep struggling and struggling with is I've really learned a lot about stepping back, not picking up what isn't mine when I recognize that it isn't mine. Sometimes it gets kind of blurry, and I see something that I'm not sure whether it's mine or not. And it usually has to do with a child or an elderly person, and not to do anything doesn't seem right. But then I'm not sure whether I'm falling into my old stuff.
What's something you can do to clarify?
Make an appointment with you.
Given that you live in Baltimore and I'm in LA, that could be a problem in the situation. It's not too practical. I'm thinking of something you can do without me. because that'll be much more helpful to you.
Well, I can sit with it.
Yeah, there's a three-letter word. And it's not sit. Ask.
Put an example with a child.
Mm-hmm.
Ask who?
Well, it won't be possible in all situations, but with the if there's a child in pain, I'll give you an example, actually. Before I did the three-year retreat, I was married, and my wife and I ran a foster home for a year. We had a number of kids in it. One of them was a 12-year-old boy who was a bit rambunctious, basically a good kid. One day, there was a knock on the door, and there was the 12-year-old boy with the police officer behind him. He'd been caught for shoplifting. And the store owner hadn't prosecuted, etc., so that was good. We notified the social workers that oversaw the whole thing and worked through it all. Then and his room was in the basement of the house, which had been redone, but that's where he was. So it was pretty clear that he was suffering. And so he'd gone to bed, and I decided I'd just go down. And I sat in his by his bed. And basically didn't say anything. I wasn't really sure what to do. I was in my early 20s at this point. And eventually said, "Life's getting a bit complicated and rough, isn't it?" And he went, "Yeah." And then I said, "Is there anything I can do?" I asked. And he shook his head and said, "No." But I could tell that he really appreciated me just being there. So there are many situations when, you know, he didn't want advice, he didn't want encouragement, he didn't want support or anything like that. Didn't want to be taken care of. So you can ask. Now, that won't be possible in all situations, but if you aren't clear about whether it's appropriate to do something or not, and it is possible to ask, then you can try that.
And I have done that when it's possible.
Yeah.
What if it's not possible?
Then you make your best guess and live for the results. And that's all we can do. Okay. Other questions coming out of any of this? Leslie.
The power relationship, when it's not appropriate, sounds like another variation of the victim-perpetrator.
Well, the victim-rescuer-perpetrator, persecutor, triad, usually, I mean, definitely the persecutor's working power, making life miserable for the victim until it moves. That particular dynamic crops up frequently, generally crops up when there's boundaries are being violated, and will arise actually in any of the contexts, but is usually associated with either addiction or with the control and compassion. But the particular way that it functions when you're in the persecutor role or the rescuer role or whatever. It could be either through power or ecstasy or insight or compassion. So it can have all of those flavors. Yeah. The big thing with that is to recognize. Does everybody know what we're talking about? This triad. This is a triad that I think was first identified by Virginia Satir back in the late 50s. A dynamic that operated in where there was addiction in the family, and that the way that two people would interact would go through a cycle, where person A would do something to person B, which would make B feel like a victim, so A was the persecutor, and then when B was thoroughly victimized, A would become the rescuer and seek to help them. As they helped them, then B would become the persecutor for payback, A would become the victim, and then B would become the rescuer. And you just had this thing which spun around and around and around. Gave rise to a pseudo-connection, but there was no actual real connection between the two people. And this just went on and on, as you could see this dynamic. I've done exercises. I had a really neat exercise, and then I forgot it. But it allowed you to see how this dynamic can operate literally sentence by sentence. And you'll see people are in it that if one of them starts to step out of that particular dynamic, then the other spins even faster and faster in it. So you'll hear it sentence by sentence, changing those different roles. But they can threaten with power, rescue with opening, or manipulate, or be tyrannical. All of that can enter into it. Okay. Anything else? Other questions? Okay. Now, let's turn to relationships which are very important to us. In our intimate relations, and by those I'm talking about close friends and partners, spouses, the two appropriate dynamics are ecstasy and compassion. There may be a bit of insight. Very rarely, if ever, power. With friends, there may be a little more insight because friends can do that. But in really close, intimate things, it's going to be primarily compassion and ecstasy. Why not insight? Because when insight is taking place, one person is becoming the other's teacher. And one of my students, very bright guy, but in this area, very stupid. See, when my wife gets angry with me, I try to explain to her about non-self, and she just gets angrier. I said, you're lucky she doesn't kill you. So look at your own relationships in that way. When all of us are intelligent, all of us, because through our spiritual practice, can often see what is going on in the other person. Sometimes all too clearly, right? Why do we move to the teacher role? Anybody here guilty of that? Yeah, okay. Why do we move to the teacher role? It's very simple, because compassion is so damn hard. Just to be there with that person, with their stuff running, and all the pain that's involved, is just really, really hard. We want to do something about it. We want to fix them. We want to tell them, you don't have to do it this way, etc. But what happens when we move into the teacher role? Yeah. Pardon?
It's worse.
Yes, because you're cutting. You follow? Joan, where's the microphone? Just a second, please.
I say this after many years of marriage, that the only time in my relationship with my husband that insight is okay is when it's asked for.
And it's even then, you have to be very careful.
Yeah. Not to go on and on.
Pardon? you tried that, did you?
I tried.
Yes. It has to be asked for, and you better check that it is really being asked for. Because you're moving into the teacher role at that point. And to do so temporarily for a short period of time may be okay. But if it starts to happen frequently, a different dynamic is set up in the relationship. And one needs to be alert for that. Because that can actually change the whole relationship. Valerie, you're looking at me very intently.
I guess I'm definitely guilty of stepping out of bounds.
Okay, well, just to clear the record, is there anybody who hasn't fallen into this trap here?
But I guess what I'm wondering now is, you know, when you can see that the other person is making a choice or whatever, doing the things that they do, and you're going to be in the mess that's made, and this can take many forms.
Yep.
Now, at what point is it self-preservation?
Well, you raise a very important point. So I'm going to come at this whole topic at right angles to the way I've just been addressing it. Another way of looking at relationships is according to the basis of the relationship. And one of the simpler schemes, which as far as I know comes from Chinese sources, but I don't have an actual reference for it. There are relationships for which the basis is mutual benefit. The basis is a shared aim. And the basis is emotional connection. Now, a mutual benefit relationship is one which consists of a series, and maybe a single, or a series of transactions that outside of those transactions there is no relationship. So, buyer-seller. You know, you go to the corner store, or you go to the hot dog vendor, and maybe you're a regular customer. And you go to the dry cleaners, you know, give him the clothes. He gives you clean clothes back, you pay him some money. It's a transaction. There isn't any other relationship outside of that transaction. It doesn't have to be money. It can be mutual admiration. You know, I admire you, you admire me, we both feel good, fine. There are a lot of relationships between people that's the contract. And when one person stops admiring the other, there's all hell to pay. Or when one person looks for a deeper thing, the whole thing falls apart. One of my coaching clients, and he should have known better because he works in Hollywood, but he started to date this actress. He just was so attracted to her. And I said, "You're nuts." He said, "I know, but I think it can work, Ken." And then something came up in which he asked her to enter his world. Didn't happen. That was the end of the relationship right there. So it can be mutual admiration. This is one of the reasons why I think the whole school of psychology called transactional analysis is so wrong. Because it sought to reduce emotional connections to a series of transactions. And just takes the emotional life out of the relationship. Really bad stuff. People who come up with this stuff should be shot. Pardon? Is that a what statement?
Power statement.
Power statement. No, it's an anger statement. Okay. Shared aim. You enter into a shared aim relationship to do something with somebody that neither of you can do by yourselves. Raise a family. It's a shared aim relationship. Start a business. Get legislation passed. Social action. Lots of examples. But these typically require more resources, more manpower, more energy, more time, whatever, than a single person can bring to bear. It doesn't have to be equal amounts. But both people must have a say in the shared aim. Because if one person has all the say, guess what? It's not a shared aim anymore. It's that person's aim and the other person's working for them. So it degenerates to a mutual benefit. So in a shared aim, people agree on what they're trying to do and then set about doing it. It's a deeper relationship than just mutual benefit. And it's probably the proper domain for most nonprofits. It's also the proper domain for all the professional relationships. That is, lawyer, client, accountant, client, teacher, student, doctor, patient. These are all, properly speaking, shared aim relationships in which the shared aim is the growth or protection of the welfare of the person who's the client or patient. So if it's a doctor-patient, the shared aim is the patient's health. The doctor's reimbursed for time and effort, but that's the aim of the relationship. There's a very good article in the New Yorker a couple of months ago by Gawande, I think, on what is wrong with the health system in this country, and he does it by exploring what actually is the reason why healthcare costs are constantly increasing. And there are two things. One is doctors paid by procedure. So it's in their economic interest to do more procedures. And those doctors who view their patients as profit centers naturally do more procedures. And so they've reduced the shared aim to a mutual benefit. And that's what's driving the healthcare costs. And that's not being addressed at all, unfortunately. So, you have a comment, Junior? Yeah, but no, but this is in America, not in Canada.
Well, I don't know about there, but I think it's more to do with the patient wanting the maximum, everything that's possible. As I hear it, people come into their doctor and have a sore shoulder and want an MRI today.
Okay. There's also, yeah, there's also that. Julia, did you have a comment?
I did want to say that one of the things that Obama's been talking about is changing the basis of that.
He has.
Doctors are rewarded for keeping their patients well rather than for treating them.
Yes. That's encouraging, because I hadn't heard that. So, when an attorney takes a case on contingency, it's now been moved to a mutual benefit relationship. And that's why you get very different dynamics operating in contingency cases compared to a fee case, which can work right against the interests of the client. Teacher-student relationship, therapist-patient relationship. When the teacher or the therapist is trying to get something from themselves other than reimbursement for their time, and whatever, whether it's political connections or social connections or whatever, then that distorts the relationship. Third kind of relationship is emotional connection. I find this is best summed up with the following. I'm not with you because I want to be happy. I'm with you because I want to be with you. And that applies to friends, applies to partners, applies to spouses. I was giving a guest lecture out down in Orange County somewhere, and a friend of mine does a number of program on attention for business schools, and he asked me. Usually ask me to come and give the second last lecture on difficult conversations, etc. And I usually talk about this stuff. And so I trotted out this line, and one guy at the back of the class went, "Oh my God." And I got an email from him the next day. And he said, that line changed my marriage. He went back that evening, apparently, and said to his wife, "I've been killing myself trying to make you happy. I quit. I just want to be with you." And it just opened up a discussion which completely changed the dynamics of their marriage and moved it from what I guess was a kind of mutual benefit thing to it, or revitalized or reconnected on the emotional. They just wanted to be together, and they started looked at actually creating life of just being together. That's why you have in the marriage vows, for a richer or poorer, or better or worse, etc., etc. It's not about being a certain way. It's about being together. So that's very important. And the emotional connection relationship is, of the three, is much the deepest. You'll very rarely find people willing to give life for a mutual benefit relationship. You will sometimes find people who are willing to give their life for a shared aim, defending country, dying for a cause. And you'll very frequently find that people give their life for someone for whom they have an emotional connection. That's how important it is. So this is a different way of looking at it. One other piece on this, just to complete the picture. What undermines a mutual benefit relationship is an aversion to risk. When you give your clothes to the dry cleaner, you don't actually know what's going to happen to them. And you can follow them all the way through the whole thing, making sure everything happens, but then you might as well just be cleaning them yourself. So there's some risk involved. And the person who you give money to, your credit card or whatever, he doesn't know that that's actually real money. But there's that element of risk and trust. You can't have a mutual benefit relationship if you're completely risk averse. And it's recognized very much in investment. A person who shoulders 20% of the risk gets 20% of the reward or the profits, and the person who shoulders 80% gets 80%. What undermines a shared aim relationship is a need for control. And that's what all the problems in nonprofit organizations are usually about. What undermines an emotional connection relationship is the desire for continual happiness. It just doesn't work that way. Okay. One last piece on this. This is a principle. The next principle applies to all forms of relationship. For any form of relationship to last, it has to be basically in balance. Now, in balance doesn't mean that it's static. In balance. No, in balance. Okay? Yes, important distinction there. Balance doesn't mean it's static. If I asked you to stand on one foot, balance on one foot, all of you could do that, but none of you would be absolutely still. There would be constant adjustment. No, maybe one of you really skilled could stand absolutely still for 2 or 3 seconds. Probably not much more than that. That constant adjustment is what gives life and vitality to a relationship. So there's a constant, things happen between two people in the world or whatever. It's moved slightly out of balance, and then it moves towards balance, and it's out of balance, and so it goes like this. And there's constant movement, and gives life and vitality. And you remember being on a teeter-totter or a seesaw as a kid. How much fun was it when you were totally equally weight and you just sat there like this? No, the fun is doing this, going up and down. And it's the same in relationships. People who are good at relationships are very good at detecting imbalances and moving things back towards balance. They aren't concerned with making sure everything is perfect all the time. If you see the difference. If you want to make things perfect all the time, you're going to end up like the teeter-totter, just sits like this. But if you're skilled in detecting imbalance, it moves, okay, it moves back. Now it moves again, it moves back and forth. And it's a live relationship, and it evolves, and all kinds of things, possibilities come out of this. No relationship can endure if there is a continuous imbalance or an ever-present imbalance. Because what this means, if we go back to the teeter-totter example, it's like one person's up here and one person's down there. Nothing's moving. Now, when there's a structural imbalance, let's say, one person is getting more out of the relationship than they're putting in, and one person is getting less out of the relationship than they're putting in. Okay? What does the person who is getting less out of the relationship feel? Resentment. What does the person who is getting more out of the relationship feel? Pardon? Well, yes. But what does he or she feel for the other person? Disdain. Because they know at some level that they're taking advantage. That's always present. You have respect and disdain. Now, resentment and disdain. No relationship can survive where those two are present. Over a period of time, over a long period of time. And this is why it is very important to address imbalances in the relationship as they arise, as they become detected. Now, the problem here, and I could use another word for problem, say the opportunity, is that every time you address an imbalance, you put the relationship at risk. You have no idea what's going to happen. Because it's going to lead to some evolution in the relationship. It may lead to the end of the relationship. You just don't know. But another principle comes in here. Relationships which don't evolve generally die. And if you look at marriage relationships, and just what you were saying earlier about your experience with your wife, something has evolved over time. That's a sign of a healthy relationship, is it's a relationship in which things can and do evolve. And so the relationship actually changes, and the dynamics in the relationship changes, and it becomes richer, and becomes something very different from what how it may have started, and what the expectations were. And necessarily, in any kind of long-term relationship, there are going to be stages which are very difficult because something needs to evolve, and one or other or both parties actually don't know how to negotiate that. And this can be in business relationships, it can be shared aim relationships, it can be in emotional connection relationships. These very, very general principles. And a lot depends on the willingness of the parties involved. Say, is this relationship important to us? Yes. Okay, then let's find a way to make it work. So in the business world, that will sometimes lead to completely redefining the relationship and the basis of the transactions. In the shared aim world, relationship, it may be that recognize, okay, we can't continue this. This aim is unrealizable. We're just bashing our heads against a brick wall. But we work very well together. What else can we do? And they move in a new direction. And in marriage or friendship, find that something else becomes possible. Henry Ford once said, it's a very wonderful thing when a business partnership becomes a friendship. It's movement from mutual benefit to emotional connection. It's a very sad thing when a friendship becomes a mutual a business relationship. This is in the opposite direction. But either things can evolve in either way. And it may involve recognizing that the basis of the relationship has changed. And this happens, of course, when a couple with a family divorces. The emotional connection is gone, but the shared aim of raising a family is still there. And it may be that people meet with the intention of doing something together and find that they have a very strong emotional connection. And so it evolves in another direction. So what I'm trying to give you here are principles that I've learned in the course of my own work in these areas, which I found clarifying and helpful. As you notice, they don't give you any specific advice about what to do in specific situations, but they do give you ways of thinking and looking at situations which may point, reveal to you what can help you negotiate a particular stage in a relationship. So, again, very happy to take any questions. And if you want to make them fairly specific about specific situations, then we can explore how these principles might apply to it to the extent that we can. Claudia.
I have a comment and a question both. Having been very guilty at times of falling into the teacher role.
With people you're close to?
Yes. In making the shift out of that into a place of compassion and just being with the person, I have experienced that in allowing myself to be with that person, I discovered that the way the person was working through their suffering, it was not the way I would have wanted them to work through it. But in fact, there was something quite amazing about the way it worked for them. And in just being there and not getting in the middle of it with them, it allowed them to develop their own path through it. And it gave me something incredible back, because I gained so much insight in watching that and observing that and being, you know, just present with that, that it really has caused me to look at things in a very, very different way many times now.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful experience, and I think it's really, thank you for that comment, because that's precisely it. They may have their own way, and you just don't teach them your way. Yeah, great.
And my question is that what you're giving us are general frameworks, but relationships, especially close relationships, shift around a lot. And it seems like to me that power elements come into almost every relationship at some time. They slide in, and
you're quite right. They slide in often because of old family or family of origin stuff, etc. And that's why one needs to be alert for them. Because, I mean, a couple of things I can throw in here. In the teacher-student relationship, it's very important that both teacher and student are there volitionally. It's the only way it can work. if there's a power element, then the person can't actually grow. They're being made to do something. Please continue.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the student can be the power element.
Yes, I've experienced that a few times. You know, if you don't teach me this way, I'm leaving. To which I usually say, okay. I'm not going to teach them that way.
I haven't experienced that a lot with students, but and not in teaching meditation, but in a classroom I have.
Yeah.
A number of times. It always used to catch me by surprise, but it would happen a lot, actually. And I got so I could sniff them out within maybe two lectures who they were. But in certain kinds of relationships, shared aim for sure, and the emotional connection aspect for sure, when the power comes up, I mean, sometimes I have tried to pull it up to the surface to discuss it. And sometimes that works, depending on the foundation in the relationship. But sometimes I have found that that is not very effective because it triggers anger and some other things, and there's sort of a deterioration in the relationship once those power elements are sort of identified.
Yes. When people's coercive methods are exposed, they usually respond in rage.
But even if it's the other way.
Or that they're insisting on being coerced.
Yes.
Yes, they still respond in rage.
Yes, because some people like that.
Well, yes, you know, you're into the sadomasochism that Julia mentioned. It can be very subtle, but what's going on there is this is the only way they know how to feel a connection. And in the scheme of things, that's balanced usually by compassion. Where over time, by just being present with them in their pain and not accepting or exerting the power element, they begin to have that experience. And so something new can evolve. But that's about the only way it changes. I mean, you can see this in international relationships all over the place. Yeah. Other comments or questions? Julia.
A question was raised earlier about a situation in which something's going on that needs to stop. For instance, a sort of chronic imbalance in relationship, for example. How do you distinguish in your frameworks between power and the setting of a boundary around an imbalance?
Very good question. I think this speaks to Claudia's point. When you stand at a boundary, you are exercising power. And this takes us into a whole another area, which we're not going to treat in full tonight. Give an example from my teaching. Had a person, student who was the kind that Claudia was describing. I wasn't making him feel like he had to do it, then he didn't feel there was any real connection. You follow? Pardon?
Yes.
And that's where I set my boundary. I said, I'm not going to make you do anything. You come to this relationship volitionally. You're here because you want to learn. And you think I may be useful in that process. But I'm not going to make you do anything. That was my boundary. I didn't do any more than that. Then he decides whether to meet that or not. You follow? Does that...
So the distinction you're making is there is no coercion of the other. There is just a statement which is clarifying about the situation.
Yes, you stand at the boundary and what happens, happens.
Yes.
Yes.
That's a sort of magnetization.
It may definitely move to magnetization and destruction, but it can start off as...
You're just going to stand in your place.
This is where I am. And you say, can we talk about that? Yes, we can talk about it. You talk it out. So that's pacification.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. Thank you.
Gary.
To take your example one step further, in setting that boundary, how do you also bring compassion to bear? Because in some sense, there's going to be some pain in setting that boundary.
This is the relationship between compassion and power, and it's very important. When you're exercising power, you do no more than is necessary because there is pain. And you stand in the experience of the pain as well. So you're there. So in this case, I'm not going to make you do anything. Okay? There's pain right there. Because I know, and this other person knows, that's going to require a different kind of relationship. And I'm willing to be with them in the pain that they experience in stepping out of the only kind of relationship they know. You follow? So that's the exercise of compassion there.
Does that also involve a sense of emotional connection, the way you've described it?
Not in the sense that the relationship becomes one of emotional connection. This is very definitely a teacher-student relationship. However, is there stuff operating emotionally? Absolutely. And because the person with whom this was taking place struggled inside, didn't know how to relate. And I was willing to be present. Now, I have to tell you, in this particular situation, it was extremely painful for me, too. Because this person was adept at creating coercive situations in which either I was being pulled into coercing him, or he was trying to coerce me. And so all through this, it was just like, because I was trying to be in the teacher-student relationship, not pulled into a authoritarian coerce, you know, just you do this or else, which the other person he would have been much more comfortable with. So, and I found it very, very difficult, but it did actually evolve in that direction. So, I'm quite happy about the result, but it was not easy. Okay, and that particularly when relationships are evolving into a new dynamic, there really is pain because you're letting go of expectations, hopes, and certain kinds of connections, while other kinds of connections and other directions and other possibilities form. And there's both joy and pain in that process. Just how it is. Okay. Other comments or questions? Now, just for my edification here, any of you find any of this useful? Okay, so give me a little feedback here on how you're finding this useful. Tom. And then you, Pat.
For my relationship with my wife, the part about the teaching relationship clarified a lot of problems I've been having, so thank you so much.
Occupational what's the term I want? Pardon? Occupational hazard, that's right.
Yeah, we're both professionals and we love to teach each other. It's like death.
Ow.
I think as a teacher it's so easy to not be able to pull out threads of different relationships that you're having. So even with my colleagues, the idea of insight is there. It's there every day,
yes,
as we co-teach. And it's a beautiful thing when it happens, but the cutting is cutting.
Yes, it is.
You know, and to acknowledge that is really important.
Yeah, I can go a little further with that, because you mentioned you're in co-teaching situations. Mm-hmm. Because you're both employing insight in your co-teaching, in any co-teaching situation, you're going to emerge from that cut and bruised. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when there is no intention to hurt each other, you're still going to emerge from it cut and bruised. And it's good to talk through that afterwards.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think in a co-teaching experience, what you mirror is your relationship. So in front of your students, that's, you know, you're taking off your clothes, layer after layer after layer.
Yeah,
so
it's a
process of being cut in public.
I think you ought to work on your co-teaching skills there. Because I probably haven't done as much co-teaching as you, but...
I don't mean in a negative way. I mean, I think in a very positive way, I feel that.
Okay.
The connection is palpable.
Yeah.
And cutting is a dialogue and a...
I see. Yeah. Okay. Because in the co-teaching I've done, actually take quite a lot of care. So to keep the cutting that's going back and forth this way to a minimum.
Right.
For two reasons. It provides when you have that kind of partnership, it provides a very, very powerful positive atmosphere. So the possibility of learning for people is greatly enhanced. And also the point that you mentioned earlier, it's a model for a certain for relationship, and people are inspired or warmed by that in a very good way, because when you have two people teaching, the projections onto anyone are much are greatly reduced. So people can actually learn what they're meant to learn instead of thinking it's this magical person up there.
Absolutely, and I think at the beginning I was so afraid of any of contradicting my partner that I would try to hide anything that would happen that didn't seem like we were the same person. So, but now I think it's interesting.
Yeah,
it's it gives people the chance to know themselves better as we know ourselves better.
Yeah,
and so the cutting is done with care and with love and with respect.
I'm just thinking of my colleague Michael Conklin. We've co-taught together a few times, and so we were teaching up in Seattle together, and I said something, and he just went, "You promised not to say that, Ken." And everybody was like, so it was a lot of fun. Okay. Comment, Gary? We're done, are we? Yeah, okay, we're done. Okay, so I'm glad that you may have found this helpful. We'll have opportunity to pursue this. Any questions or comments in the days ahead? Okay, I think we're done. We'll just do a few minutes meditation to close.
Retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.